From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. Life of Brian, Monty Python's biblical satire, is back in theaters 25 years after it was first released. It's about Brian Cohen, born one stable over from Jesus, who gets mistaken for him. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with the troupe's Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Michael Palin, and Eric Idle. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Troy, starring Brad Pitt. And Frasier fans said goodbye to the show last night. We have a review of the final episode. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The U.S. military has banned several controversial interrogation methods in Iraq as Congress looks into the scandal involving abuse of Iraqi prisoners by some American troops. Among the methods now off limits are sleep and sensory deprivation and putting prisoners into so-called stress positions for hours at a time. Nearly 300 Iraqi prisoners were released from the Abu Ghraib prison today. A few said they had been humiliated and psychologically pressured by American troops, but not physically abused. U.S. forces in Iraq pushed farther into Najaf today to flush out militiamen loyal to radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Sadr's gunmen also attacked U.S. occupation headquarters in Nasiriya. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Baghdad.
Members of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army fired several rocket-propelled grenades at the U.S. headquarters in Nasiriya. Italian soldiers returned fire. Earlier, Sadr's men stormed the governor's office in Nasiriya. In Najaf, American forces moved into a large cemetery where Sadr's men were holed up. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett in Baghdad told reporters that he didn't believe U.S. forces had hit the nearby shrine to the Imam Ali, which residents reported had been damaged by gunfire. Kimmett accused Sadr's fighters of using the shrine as cover for their violent attacks. The Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the most prominent Shiite cleric in Iraq, called on both sides to end the violence. A Sadr representative called on Iraqis to join the battle against the Americans and condemn those who remained silent. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Baghdad.
A memorial service was held today for Nick Berg, the American who was beheaded by Islamic militants in Iraq. Attorney General John Ashcroft says Berg was investigated in 2002 for possible connections to terrorist activity, but no such links were found.
The suggestion that Mr. Berg was in some way involved in terrorist activity or may have been linked in some way involved in terrorist activity is a suggestion that we do not have any ability to support, and we do not believe.
Ashcroft speaking to reporters in Washington today. The U.S. Supreme Court has reportedly rejected a last-minute appeal designed to block gay marriages in Massachusetts, which are to become legal on Monday. Earlier today, a federal appeals court also denied a request by opponents of same-sex marriages, as Fred Tice of member station WBUR reports.
The First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston says that it's not obvious that the handling of the disagreement over same-sex marriage in Massachusetts deprives the citizens of the state of their constitutional right to a Republican form of government. That was the question that the three-judge panel was asked to answer, and so they denied a request to stop gay weddings, which are due to start Monday. But the court did agree to hear arguments in the case next month. That, of course, would be too late to delay same-sex weddings for NPR.
This is NPR News. An Israeli helicopter fired missiles at a target in Gaza City today. No word yet on casualties. That attack comes after a week of intense fighting there. Two Israeli soldiers and a Palestinian man were killed earlier today. Israeli troops searching for the bodies of five fellow soldiers killed in an explosion knocked down at least 35 buildings in a refugee camp. Nortel Networks has been subpoenaed by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Dallas as part of a criminal investigation following the company's recent restatement of its financial results. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Securities regulators in the U.S. and Canada have been taking a close look at Nortel's financial records. The company is preparing to restate its financial records from the beginning of 2001. It also restated its profits for last year, cutting them in half from the $732 million first posted. In addition, last month, Nortel's board fired the top three executives, including CEO Frank Dunn. In the latest move, a U.S. grand jury has requested financial statements and corporate personnel and accounting records going back to the year 2000. The company says it will cooperate fully with U.S. authorities, and officials refuse to speculate on the reason for the subpoena. Nortel has nearly 5,000 workers in the U.S. with major operations in Dallas, Atlanta, Mission Park, California, and Nashville. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The Justice Department says at least 65 arrests have been made and hundreds of cases are under investigation in a new crackdown on the exchange of child pornography over the Internet. In particular, the probes are focusing on peer-to-peer file swapping, or P2P for short, which is harder to track than traditional downloading from websites. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed up 2 points at 10,012 in active trading, but the Nasdaq lost 21 to close at 1904. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop celebrates dads and grads with a variety of gift ideas selected with the discerning public radio fan in mind at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. And this is one of the parents of one of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Are you into this? Uh-huh. Hello. My name is Muriel Cleese, and I live in a very nice elderly people's home in Weston-super-Mare. My son John is in the new Monty Python film, Life of Brian. Do hope you'll go and see it, because he's on a percentage, and he says if it doesn't do well, he won't be able to keep me on in the home any longer. So see The Life of Brian now, because I'm 102 years old, and if I have to leave here, it'll kill me.
In 1979, when Monty Python's Life of Brian was released, Cleese and company had a lot more to worry about than whether John's mom would stay comfortable. Decades before The Passion of the Christ, this British comedy troupe came up with the idea of telling a comic story about someone who lived during the lifetime of Jesus Christ. Life of Brian also ended with a crucifixion, only this time the people on the cross were singing. Blasphemy? That's how many people felt at the time. Think about how much controversy Mel Gibson's movie stirred today. Then go back in time a few decades and substitute comedy for drama. Here are Michael Palin and Eric Idle in a typically irreverent scene.
Next. Crucifixion.
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion.
Yes.
Good. Out of the door, line on the left, one cross each. Next. Crucifixion?
No, freedom.
Mm-hmm. What?
Freedom for me. They said I hadn't done anything so I could go free and live on an island somewhere.
Oh. Oh, well, that's jolly good. Well, off you go then.
Nah, man, you're pulling your leg. It's crucifixion, really.
Oh, I see. Very good, very good. Well, out of the door.
Yeah, another way. Out the door, one line cross each, line on the left.
Line on the left, yes. Thank you. Crucifixion?
Yes.
Good.
The original studio backing the film, England's EMI Studios, withdrew its funding just as shooting was about to commence. It was only when George Harrison came to the rescue and provided the money to complete and distribute the film that Monty Python's Life of Brian was saved. Harrison said then that Monty Python was the comic reincarnation of the Beatles. And given how much trouble John Lennon got into when talking about how the Beatles were bigger than Christ, it was an apt comparison. Life of Brian continued getting in trouble, too. It wasn't even released in England until after it premiered in America. Religious leaders in both countries attacked it. But once the film was seen and embraced by audiences, who enjoyed its silliness as well as its subtext, Life of Brian was hailed as a success. On its 25th anniversary, Life of Brian is being re-released in a big way, not just on DVD, where it's available already, but in movie theaters, where it opened recently. In the context of The Passion of the Christ, it has a new currency. But the movie doesn't need that association or that excuse to be resurrected and enjoyed. Today on Fresh Air, we visit with four of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus: John Cleese, Michael Palin, Eric Idle, and our first guest, Graham Chapman. Chapman, who died in 1989, spoke to Terry 2 years earlier. In Life of Brian, Chapman has the title role as Brian Cohen, the film's reluctant would-be messiah. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman was a trained physician and a gay rights activist. Before the interview, let's hear him in a classic Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings.
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit. Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert.
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. Terry asked him if his early sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable. I suppose because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and that they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different.
Yes, I suppose there are, although we were quite fortunate in that respect in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that will be pretty meaningless now.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
John and I wrote together, Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together, Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe... anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything. And at that point, we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation, open up Roger's Thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of your sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's Thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pickle crema? No. Danish
pizza? When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers with in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or bury
them,
or dump them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you know, fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Graham Chapman, speaking with Terry Gross in 1987, 2 years before his death. He has the title role in Monty Python's Life of Brian, re-released now in theaters and on DVD. Of all the Monty Python players, John Cleese arguably is the most famous. He has the most successful non-Python comedy film in A Fish Called Wanda. He's part of the James Bond franchise now, playing Q, the exasperated weapons specialist who gives new gadgets to the new 007. And on TV, he starred in and co-wrote one of the classic comedies of all time, Fawlty Towers. When Terry spoke to Cleese in 1990, it wasn't comedy that had brought him to town. It was a family therapy conference where he led a seminar with his former therapist, Robin Skinner.
Now, so much of your humor has to do with, kind of skewering a certain businessman mentality or civil service mentality. Now, your father was an insurance salesman, and I wonder if you got some of what those people were like from watching your father and his...
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's right. And I think if somebody had to say, what's the thread running almost all the way through my work, it's something to do with trying to escape from a sort of rather narrow, rather respectable, lower middle class inhibition. And that's really what my work's been about, if I think about it. And Wanda was a supreme example of that, where Archie finally sort of throws it all up and disappears to Rio with Jamie Lee Curtis, you know. So I think that that's probably been informing my work more than anything else, along, I think, with two other things. I think that people in their work, comedians, often try and laugh at the thing that frightens them most and attempt to sort of make it less threatening. And I've always been scared of anger. The English are very uncomfortable with anger. I don't know if it's anything particularly to do with my family, but it's certainly to do with the English family, more than the British family, if you see what I mean. They hate anger. They regard it as a loss of face, to really, you know, sound off, and they find it very difficult to express it, and so they get pushed around a bit, and they don't complain well if they get bad service. And the other thing is that because of, I think, something early in my life too, I've always been very scared of lack of communications. I've laughed at that a great deal.
Wait, can I ask you to talk in no language for a second, speaking of lack of communication?
In?
No language. You have this way of speaking in no language in particular.
Oh, the Cards and the Tempertonies. Yeah, well, they murder, glupose and overcull at the Murgle chooses. There's to be looks across the bottom, part of Isaac cruise together in mid celebrity and appetity. And fourth frame shows data vision and auditory slope of action. But I won't go on about that at the moment. I know it's confusing if you haven't heard it before.
So is this kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I actually heard an English guy called Stanley Unwin talking that nonsense when I was 17, I mean, I laughed for about a week. I mean, I just laughed till I hurt.
How did you learn to speak in that gobbledygook?
Believe it or not, it is. When I was 18, I wrote it down, and I simply wrote it.
Really?
Yes, the first half of words and put the second half of other words on. I can't make it up. It sounds as if I'm making it up, but that's actually something that I learned for a house entertainment at Clifton College in 1958. And I've never forgotten it. They got me into the Footlights in Cambridge, too, is how I started there.
Oh, that's great. John Cleese, who were the first people who you realized you could do convincing characterizations of?
The first dozen things I did were very derivative of things that other people had done that had made me laugh. But after that, I use the fact that if somebody is going to have a nervous tick, you know, and make chicken noises now and again, it's much funnier if they're the head of the Secret Service or the chairman of the Bank of England than if they're a tobacconist. So I use my ability to pass myself off as a sort of establishment figure because of my public school education to portray these kind of people. Because, as I say, the more serious and grave they are, the funnier it is when they start going a bit crazy.
This seems like there's a time in your life when you could have swung either way, either into the real straight life or into a parody of that.
Through writing and acting. Yeah, when I left Cambridge, I was actually signed up to join a huge firm of solicitors in the City of London called Freshfields, who were solicitors to the Bank of England, and about half the partners were lords or knights or something. So, and if the BBC hadn't come along about a week before I left Cambridge and seen the review that we were all doing, Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and a number of other people who've been successful in show business and offered us all jobs, I imagine I would have gone and been a solicitor and done that for 15, 20 years before killing myself.
That's grim.
Well, I mean, no, I think you're a solicitor. I think killing yourself's quite a cheerful prospect.
Well, he's grinning.
Now, your mother was an acrobat? Is that, this happens to me all
I'm
the
sorry,
time.
I'm getting fed up sometimes. People send me these.
No, you know, I always, like, very seriously read, you know, these bios of the people I'm interviewing, and there's usually, like, one piece of information that is so dreadfully wrong.
That's right. I forgot I put that on some bio.
Oh, so you wrote that.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm reading the stuff about you, and I know half of this is probably made up, and I have no idea which half it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, you're quite right. You get fed up fitting those biographies in, and you do put in the odd thing, and then, of course, it's played back to you a few months later. You've totally forgotten them. No, she wasn't too much of an acrobat. She was staid-ish, played the piano, and otherwise was a housewife.
John Cleese, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Monty Python's Life of Brian is back in theaters 25 years after it was first shown. We'll continue our tribute to the Pythons after this break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Palin was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus and co-starred in the Python films including Monty Python and the Holy Grail, The Meaning of Life, and The Life of Brian, which is now back in theaters 25 years after it was first released. Palin also appeared with fellow Python John Cleese in the films A Fish Called Wanda and Fierce Creatures. More recently, he's done some very intelligent and funny travel series for television. Terry Gross spoke to him in 1990 and asked him about his upbringing.
Well, I was a nice middle-class boy, I suppose. I mean, my mother didn't work. My father was an engineer by trade and was born and brought up in the south of England. He was a doctor's son. And he became an export manager of a big steelworks in Sheffield. I don't think he really particularly wanted to do that. I mean, I think he'd actually been much happier to be a church organist, but one was sort of pushed into the professions then. And so we lived on really very low salary in quite a nice house in Sheffield.
You grew up after the war. How did the post-war days affect your sensibility, do you think, and you know your worldview when you were young?
Well, the days of austerity and scarcity here, and I can remember countries like America and Australia especially were like the land of plenty where all the opportunities were. It meant, in a strange way, that you sort of guarded what you had rather carefully. I mean, my father was a real notebook man and kept brown paper bags for several years, you know, and used to iron bits of string. It was that sort of thing, and had lots and lots of little tins with sort of, you know, left-handed cufflinks and things in one tin and bits of, you know, sort of old Brazil nut shells in another. We kept absolutely everything. And I quite like that. I'm still rather, I love detail myself, both in sort of life and work. I tend to notice bits of detail. And in a sense, it's made me sort of or perhaps helped to make me feel very sort of fond of life and rather sort of glad that I've got what I have now and that we are brought up in a time of comparative plenty.
The Pythons always had a lot of drag humor. I was wondering if you were ever taken to drag shows or, you know, to female impersonation shows when you were younger.
No, not really. I went to pantomime, which is a peculiarly English phenomenon, I think, isn't it? You don't have pantomime in America.
Well, explain what it is.
Well, it's a Christmas show based on a reworking of a fairy story like Jack and the Beanstalk or Babes in the Wood, in which the women play the men and the men play the women.
I don't think we have that.
Well, they have Principal Boy, which is always played by a woman in a big pair of black tights and sort of little costume. She slaps her thigh a lot and, you know, the woman would play Dick Whittington, for instance, and say, "Come on, puss," and all that in a sort of very butch voice. And the men would play the Ugly Sisters and Cinderella. So that was my first, I suppose, that, you know, every Christmas I would see men in getting laughs out of being in drag, playing things like the Ugly Sisters or Dick Whittington's mother or things like that. And they were always fairly incompetent. I don't know if that's a sign of, you know, how men saw themselves or how men saw women, but there you are.
How often did you dress in drag for the Python shows?
it sounds like sort of drag addicts confessions, doesn't it? Not really that often. Uh-huh. I should think probably once every other show we got into women's outfits. Mm. Strange, isn't it, really? I must say we did quite enjoy it. Because Python was sort of rather like, I mean, people say, why didn't you get women to play the women in Python? But that wasn't really the point. Python itself was sort of a really self-contained show where the six writers did everything. And the sort of many of the characters were rather sort of caricatures, or fairly outrageous, of a sort of cartoon feel to them. And so we were playing types of men rather than the man himself. And we were playing types of women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I never convinced myself as a woman, whereas someone like Eric or Graham could look really rather wonderful. And Terry Jones, used to play his mother regularly and was wonderful. You know, one could almost think, I wish Terry would stay like that. He'd make someone a wonderful mum.
Michael Palin, formerly of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Their film, Monty Python's Life of Brian, is back in theaters after 25 years. We have one more Python coming up in the second part of our show. Eric Idle, with his guitar. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I chop down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesdays I go shopping and have buttered scones for tea.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Plant Life, a novel about the meaning of family, friendship, and forgiveness, now in paperback by Pamela Duncan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of Monty Python. We hear from Eric Idle. Also, David Edelstein reviews Troy, and Seattle's sitcom family ends its 11-year run. We have a review of the final episode of Frasier. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The 1979 movie Monty Python's Life of Brian, a comedy that takes place during the lifetime of Jesus Christ, has been re-released on DVD and in theaters. On today's archive edition, we're hearing from several of the members of the British comedy troupe. Eric Idle wrote many of the comic songs used in Python sketches and movies. He also was a prominent figure in The Ruddles, playing the Paul McCartney role in that brilliant parody of the Beatles. And here he is in a scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, their parody of the King Arthur legend. Idle is looking for the Grail and has found a clue carved in a cave.
There, look! What does it say? What language is that? Brother Maynard, you're our scholar. It's Aramaic. Of course, Joseph of Arimathea.
Of course.
What does it say?
It reads, here may be found the last words of Joseph of Arimathea. He who is valiant and pure of spirit may find the Holy Grail in the castle of...
What?
The castle of...
What is that?
He must have died while carving it.
Oh, come on.
Well, that's what it says.
Look, if he was dying, he wouldn't bother to carve Arg. He'd just say it.
Well, that's what's carved in the rock.
Perhaps he was dictating. Oh, shut up. Well, does it say anything else?
No. Just Arg.
That was Eric Idle translating the Aramaic. When Terry spoke with him in 1999, he performed some of the songs he wrote during his years with the Pythons. He had just published his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars, set in the 24th century. The main character is an android named Carlton. He's writing a thesis on the nature of 20th century comedy, investigating whether there is a comedy gene. As part of his research, he's watching tapes of old TV shows. Here's a reading.
He thinks he almost finds some evidence with one of the guys on a very weird show called Monty Python's Flying Circus. I've seen the tapes, and boy, does it suck. It's strange rather than funny. Five limeys and a yank. No girls, they did drag. Typical Brits. They're never happier than when dressing up as women. What is it with them? It's a stupid show, as I say, and Carlton found it totally puzzling. Heads come off or pop open in demented animations. Sheep drop on people's heads for no reason whatsoever. Vikings sing love songs to pressed meat. Weird men dressed as old ladies squeak in silly voices. There are dead parrots and Spanish Inquisitions. It's all very silly nonsense. They seem dangerously cuckoo to me. Carlton couldn't make head or tail of it. But it seemed from the tape that the audience laughed. As far as he could tell, it was genuine, not canned laughter. In casually cross-checking the genetic backgrounds of the six strange men involved, he turned up an ancestor for one of them in showbiz. Eric Idle's great-grandfather, Henry Bertrand, a Victorian gentleman from the 1890s, had been a circus manager. Was this the genetic missing link? His great-grandfather was a ringmaster in a circus, and Idle was in a flying circus? Surely this was significant. Of course it wasn't. Turned out Idle was screwed up by losing his RAF rear gunner father in a traffic accident in World War II. Irony, eh? Killed coming home from on Christmas leave after surviving the war. This was compounded by being stuck in a semi-orphanage for 12 years with a bunch of fatherless boys. The circus thing was just a coincidence, but you can see the lengths he went to in searching for the comedy gene.
Well, thanks for reading that excerpt of your book, The Road to Mars. And before I get to some of the things about your biography that are referred to in that passage, I want to ask you a little bit about the comedy of Monty Python. I mean, it looks ridiculous to Carlton centuries after the fact. He doesn't understand at all the surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs that the Python's comedy was based on. And I'm wondering why you think that so much of the Python comedy was based on surrealism and non sequiturs.
Well, first of all, Carlton doesn't get it because he's an android. He doesn't get much.
Good point. Thank
he
you.
He has no sense of irony whatsoever. And if you tell him to say, people say, like, get out of here, he leaves the room. And that's part of his problem, really. He can't understand the secondary levels of meaning in language, which is where comedy lurks. And also, it's kind of fun to sort of abuse Python from the future. It's kind of a nice, comfortable position to look back at our own work.
But getting back to the question of why so much of the Python humor was about surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs.
I think that we thought it was reality. I think that that's the way we look at things. I mean, It isn't really non-sequitur. The world doesn't make much sense, and we always try and pretend it does. And comedy's job is to point out that it doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't matter that much. And perhaps we reflected that a bit.
I thought we could take a break here and listen to another one of your songs. And this is a song that was done in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian. And the song is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Set up for us how this song is used at the very end of The Life of Brian. And Brian is somebody whose life parallels the life of Jesus, and he ends up crucified on the cross at the end of the movie. Tell us about the song here.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters. We're heading towards crucifixion, and we had to, there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans are fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And, of course, in the movie, your character's getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes. It's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. 'Cause life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. For life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do, you know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records, too. It's cheaper than musicians.
I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the nudge, nudge, wink, wink sketch. Two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Did you write this sketch?
Yes, I did write the sketch.
Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back, unused, because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean, know what I mean. Say no more, nudge, nudge, know what I mean. Say no more, nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more, know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, eh? Wink, wink, eh? Is she a goer? Eh? Does she go? Eh? And, of course, they fell about because it's kind of in the performance. And it's sometimes very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, he's a bit of a Jack the Lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end, you know. He says, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Well, let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography,
yeah? Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday, could be. Swimming costumes. Nudge, nudge. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh, eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now your father died in World War II.
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time, you guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into a bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment, and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It's probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's nine, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
Eric Idle, speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. He's one of the stars of Monty Python's Life of Brian, which has just been re-released on DVD and in theaters to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Coming up, something completely different. David Edelstein reviews the new Brad Pitt movie, Troy. This is Fresh Air. More than 3,000 years ago, the largest armada the world had ever seen sailed to the walled city of Troy to reclaim a runaway bride, the face that launched 1,000 ships. The bloody 10-year siege was recounted by Homer in the Iliad, which is the loose inspiration for Wolfgang Peterson's lavish new epic film, Troy. It stars Brad Pitt as Achilles and Eric Bana as Hector. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The story of the Trojan War comes to us largely from Homer's The Iliad. And while artists over the centuries have added their spin, the thrust has remained unchanged. For all the heroics by near-mythic warriors, this was a grotesque, needless, tragic waste of lives. It inspired the greatest of all anti-war laments, Euripides' The Trojan Women, and even Homer's martial epic would best be subtitled The Gods Must Be Crazy. Given the cost, upwards of $175 million, I'm impressed that director Wolfgang Peterson's Troy is as grimly ambivalent as it is. On one level, it's a clunky toga and sandals picture, and it does go on, although it's nowhere near as drawn out as the Trojan War. Hollywood compromises are everywhere, especially in the fate of King Agamemnon, which is bound to make people who know the Oresteia, the cornerstone of Western drama, scratch their heads. But Peterson and screenwriter David Benioff get the big themes right. The spectacle, those sweeping shots of thousands of soldiers hitting the beach, inspires awe, but more important, a kind of melancholy dread. And the exaltation of victory is matched blow for blow with revulsion. The fights, especially the ones that are mano a mano, are thrilling to watch, yet our sympathies are divided. The characters we care about most, the warriors Achilles and Hector, are on opposite sides. The Trojan War is still fought for, quote, love. The juvenile Paris, a prince of Troy, played by Orlando Bloom, steals off with the beauteous Helen, played by the German model Diane Kruger. And Helen's older husband, King Menelaus, that's Brendan Gleeson, is understandably pissed off. But the film is very careful to spell out that, for Brian Cox's Agamemnon, this is an excuse to whip up his armies to invade Troy, the last independent kingdom on the Aegean. Cox's Agamemnon sniggers that Helen has, quote, proved to be very useful, and the actor must have had the urge to stroke his beard like Flash Gordon's Ming the Merciless. In truth, this Helen has a face that would launch maybe 100 ships. Throw in that lithe body and a favorable wind, maybe 250. The real erotic object is Brad Pitt's Achilles. He's the rock star of the Greek army. He's at his most glorious in battle. He turns killing into an art form, yet he'd rather stay in his tent with some comely wench or two than fight for Agamemnon, whom he loathes.
A great victory was won today, but that victory is not yours. Kings did not kneel to Achilles.
Perhaps the kings were too far behind to see. The soldiers won the battle.
History remembers kings, not soldiers. Tomorrow we'll batter down the gates of Troy. I'll build monuments to victory on every island of Greece. I'll carve Agamemnon in the stone.
Be careful, King of Kings. First, you need the victory.
Pitt is not the first actor to leap to mind to be cast as the godlike, muscle-bound killing machine, torn between lust for eternal glory and the human desire to continue his line. But give an actor an excuse to hit the gym for 4 hours a day and watch those biceps bloom. He's bronzed. He preens magnetically. He's comfortable being nude. You can tell he lives for scenes where he gets to wash his naked torso with those huge new arms. When he fights, he has an amazing killing move. He leaps and thrusts his sword from on high in a lightning scorpion strike. Okay, he's a tad Melrose Place. But that goes along with dialogue like, "You must be Hector," or Agamemnon's rueful, "He's as likely to spear me as speak to me." The truth is that, unless it's Shakespeare, dialogue usually deflates this sort of movie. The actors, at least, are good enough for Shakespeare. Cox and Gleeson, Sean Bean as Odysseus, and Peter O'Toole, who in his dotage has the cadences of Katharine Hepburn. Eric Bana's Hector is in a different key than Pitt's Achilles, heroically understated, the family man who labors to keep his country at peace, but who can't win out over so much greed and stupidity. In Homer, The gods are a constant presence, bickering and fighting. Here the gods are constantly invoked by Troy's king Priam, but the old man is clearly delusional, and his counterpart, Agamemnon, sends men off to kill and be killed to serve a private, power-mad agenda. Some would see this ancient story as endlessly contemporary.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Coming up, a look at the last episode of Frasier. This is Fresh Air. Last night, the NBC sitcom Frasier showed how to end a series right. It was too late for Friends to learn from that lesson, but it doesn't matter. Frasier always was a smarter show, so it's not surprising it went out with a more satisfying finale. What was surprising, and especially welcome, is that this last episode of Frasier delivered some of the expected plot points early and never got around to another one. Yes, Frasier's dad Martin, played by John Mahoney, got married, and Daphne and Niles, played by Jane Leaves and David Hyde Pierce, had their baby. But those events came in the first half of the show, and the other expected element of the final episode was left as a cliffhanger, the efforts by Kelsey Grammer's Frasier to win his new love, played by Laura Linney. We found out at the end that he had followed her to Chicago, but also met someone on the plane that, had the show kept going, just might have been his soulmate. But we'll never know. Frasier the sitcom is over, completing a run that began when the actor first played the fussy Frasier Crane on Cheers in 1984. The year that Cheers ended, in 1993, Frasier was spun off, the same formula NBC is adopting this year with Joey after 10 years of Friends. And Matt LeBlanc's Joey, like Frasier, will be moving to a different coast and reaching out to family to make a new start without his old support system of close friends. You can copy the format, though, without matching the sophistication. Even in its last outing, the comedy of Frasier veered from visual slapstick, Niles holding a baby monkey, to clever character-driven laughter and drama. The guests in the finale were delightful, especially the three actors playing Daphne's boisterous brothers, Anthony LaPaglia, Richard E. Grant, and Robbie Coltrane. My favorite part of the Frasier finale, though, was when Frasier decided to accept a job offer in San Francisco and leave Seattle behind, just as he had said goodbye to Boston after Cheers. This gave the character of Frasier a chance to say goodbye not only to his radio audience, but to his friends and family, all of whom had gathered in his apartment to hear his surprise news. Writers Christopher Lloyd and Joe Keenan not only provided a nice sense of closure in that respect, but set up a very touching conclusion to the evolving relationship between Frasier and his father. In the premiere episode of Frasier, the father was seen as a burden, someone with whom Frasier was saddled by moving west. By the end, it was clear their time together had been well spent. And even though Frasier's relationship with brother Niles was the funniest one on the series, last night's goodbye between Frasier and his dad was the most memorable and dramatic, in no small part because John Mahoney, as Martin Crane, is such a good actor.
Oh, move over, Roz. Do you know how many operas I'm going to get dragged to now you're not around?
Well, I promise I'll fly up for all the German ones.
Yeah, and he'll be here for Christmas and Thanksgiving and birthdays, and we'll be sick of this guy.
Yeah, Dad's right. I mean, once I'm gone, there'll be no getting rid of me.
Thank you, Frasier, for, well, you know.
Last night, when Grammer ended the show by saying, "Frasier has left the building," it was for the last time. In a year when reality is eating up more and more TV space, and well-written comedies are harder to find on network TV. The enjoyment of the final Frasier will seem more bittersweet once the new fall schedules arrive. Satisfying series finales are something to treasure, but so are shows that we care enough about to care about the way they end. Will the finale of Fear Factor make anybody happy or sad or both? And even with enjoyable finales to such shows as The Apprentice and Survivor, we may care about who wins, but only until they do. I'm not thinking at all anymore about the guy who won Donald Trump's favor on The Apprentice or the gal who won the million on Survivor. But I am still thinking about Frasier, and I'm still smiling.
Hey, baby, I hear the blues are calling, tossed salads and scrambled eggs. And maybe I seem a bit confused. Yeah, maybe, but I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs. They're calling again. Scrambled eggs all over my face.
They're making me ya-ya. Tossed salads and scrambled eggs.
They're calling again.
Kelsey Grammer from the Frasier CD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wiley, publishers of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money, Dan Brighty's investigation into the company with connections to Dick Cheney and the United States military, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who commanded the U.S. peacekeepers in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. He's written a memoir called Shake Hands with the Devil. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.